This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, April 21st, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The annual Champions for Kids Razorfest is April 26th at the Razorback Stadium in Fayetteville. This free family event begins at 10 a.m. and features games, autographs, live music, and giveaways. The U of A red and white football game begins at 1 p.m. More information is available at championsforkids.org. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Mercy Hospital continues its commitment to sustainability with a new recycling program. Also, a conversation with the author of Sharecropper's Troubadour, which discusses the life of Arkansas musician John L. Hancock's. Plus, the latest installment of Arkansongs, Roby Brock has his weekly political and business news recap, and more. But first, the latest job report shows another month of positive trends. Figures released Friday by the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services show the state's unemployment rate dropped from 7.1 to 6.9%. Michael Packow, an economist with the University of Arkansas in Little Rock, says month-to-month changes often aren't too meaningful, but this report lends credence to the idea of an improving economy.
It's the first time since January of 2009 that the rate has been under 7%. That's definitely making some progress. I think more important is the trend that this continues. This was the seventh consecutive month that we've seen household employment increase and unemployment decline.
Packow does caution that some of the gains were part of a regular uptick in seasonal workforce sectors. But he says even after seasonal adjustments, employment in most sectors still showed signs of positive growth. However, according to a report released late last week, the state unemployment rate is slightly above the national average, and African Americans are experiencing joblessness at nearly three times the rate of whites. The study from Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families also states that African Americans are more likely to experience low wages and a lack of hours in part-time positions more frequently than whites. Eleanor Wheeler, a senior policy analyst with the organization, says education could close that gap.
If we start early with pre-K, that has a big impact on achievement outcomes, and it also helps to close the gap early between minority and white students. In addition to that, higher education is one of the biggest factors in employability. And if we improve access to higher education, then we can help all Arkansans have the opportunity to find good jobs.
Wheeler also argues that increasing the minimum wage would benefit families regardless of education levels. The report contends reducing employment disparities will also positively impact the economy as a whole. Another study says eliminating health disparities for Arkansas minorities would result in a reduction in direct medical care expenditures by more than $518 million. The study was presented Friday at a minority health summit at Philander Smith College in Little Rock, and it was commissioned by the Arkansas Minority Health Commission in partnership with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. The study found that more than 79% of excess medical expenditures were attributable to African Americans, who have the worst health profile among racial and ethnic groups in the state. Dr. Mick Tilford, chair of the Department of Health Policy and Management at UAMS, says that a problem lies in engaging policymakers to value health care for minorities as much as they do for non-minorities.
I've written about policymakers saying that, explicitly they say you can't put a value on a life, but when they say we can't afford health insurance in a state where people are dying at higher rates because of a lack of health care, then implicitly they are putting a value on a life, and it is low.
Dr. Tilford champions the Affordable Care Act and says he believes it will be one factor that helps improve the health status of minority populations. A decision on whether Arkansas's 2004 ban on same-sex marriage will be reaffirmed or lifted is being weighed after litigators presented nearly 3 hours of arguments Thursday. Pulaski County Circuit Judge Chris Piazza says he will have a written judgment within 2 weeks. After the proceedings, Jack Wagner, an attorney for the plaintiffs, framed the court's future decision in the context of similar litigation nationally.
This ruling won't do anything on a national level beyond add to the ever-increasing load of cases that have gone our way. You know, you saw me go over, I think, 18 different decisions, I think 14 federal courts and three state courts. all the decisions that have come out since the United States Supreme Court's decision in Windsor last June, and every single one of them has ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in those cases.
The state, represented by Assistant Attorney General Colin Jorgensen, argues the will of voters, expressed in a 2004 amendment to the state's constitution, lends legitimacy to the ban. But Wagner argues previous cases affirm fundamental rights cannot be superseded by the will of the majority. All parties involved concede a stay is likely if the ban is overturned, with the case likely to head to the state Supreme Court. Arkansas Governor Mike Beebe will receive an honorary degree next month from the University of Arkansas. According to the university, Governor Beebe will receive an honorary Doctor of Laws degree during the all-university commencement ceremony on May 10th. The governor received his undergraduate degree from Arkansas State University in 1968 and received his Juris Doctorate from the UA School of Law in 1975. Anita Huffington, a sculptor and artist based in Northwest Arkansas, will also receive an honorary degree from the U of A. Huffington, originally from Baltimore and now living near Winslow, will receive an honorary Doctor of Fine Arts degree. Her work in stone, bronze, wood, and mixed media has been featured in the collections of Crystal Bridges, the Arkansas Art Center, and the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Razorback baseball team won 2 of 3 during the weekend series at home. Arkansas defeated Vanderbilt 6-2 on Friday, then lost Saturday's game with a final score of 2-1. During yesterday's game, Arkansas held off another Vanderbilt win with a final score of 3-1. Arkansas is now 9-9 in the SEC and 25-16 on the season. The Razorbacks remain home tomorrow for a midweek series against Northwestern State. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals won 1 and lost 1 during the weekend while on the road in Tulsa. The Nats won 6-5 Friday, but the Drillers came back with a commanding 9-3 win Saturday. After the series in Tulsa, the Naturals are 4-12 on the season, and the team returns home today for a series against the Springfield Cardinals. Mostly cloudy tonight with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low of 51 in northwest Arkansas. In the Arkansas River Valley, there's a 60% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low around 56. Tomorrow, expect mostly sunny skies with highs from 72 to 77 degrees, and mostly clear tomorrow night with lows from 46 to 51. A few years ago, Mercy, the sixth largest Catholic healthcare system in the country, started working on a green initiative. According to a news release published in April of 2010, in the span of 9 months, Mercy, which at that time included a group of 30 hospitals in Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma, saved nearly $800,000 and diverted more than 20,000 pounds of waste from local landfills. Mercy Hospital, Northwest Arkansas and Rogers, has continued that commitment to sustainability. About 2 weeks ago, the hospital implemented a new program to recycle the blue wrap used to keep instruments going into an operating room sterile. The idea for the program was born from a partnership with Fayetteville-based P3 Waste Consulting. Vice President of Operations Scott Swearingen says a big part of what P3 Waste Consulting does is analyzing companies' waste streams and then figuring out if there's a more efficient way to handle it. In this instance, analysis involved a trip to the landfill.
I actually met the truck out there whenever they were dumping the compactor from the hospital. And once we got out, we suited up, biohazard suits, gloves, masks, and literally dug into the mountain of trash that came out of the compactor. And we started analyzing exactly what was in there. That's really the only way to get a sense of exactly, you know, the week's worth of trash, what it looks like.
Swearingen says they found the biggest portion of the hospital's waste was coming from the operating room. He says what seems like a simple recycling initiative can become complicated quickly because of how regulated the OR is. For example, all materials coming in and out of the room have to be accounted for. After working on this program for a bit, the blue wrap now has a specific path from the ORs on the third floor to a loading dock located on the west side of the hospital.
So right now we're down on the ground floor. the material gets generated up on the third floor, so it has to make the trip down the elevator into the central processing area, where we'll then get sorted out and brought outside.
On the loading dock, the hospital's waste is separated into different bins. Medical waste is disposed into red containers that are placed on some metal shelving. Cardboard is placed into one bin, paper and plastic are both placed into another, and trash is placed in yet another dumpster. The blue wrap, which is tied up in clear plastic bags, is placed into one of two smaller metal bins sitting on the dock. Swearingen says the blue wrap is regulated, so it can't be remanufactured into the same sterile wrap, but it can be made into other items like a dog bowl, a park bench, or even a recycle can. Before all that can happen, though, the material has to be hauled off and sold to a buyer. That's where the Benton County Solid Waste District comes in.
It's a number 5 polypropylene plastic wrap, and what this is used for is to keep the equipment sterile as it goes pre-case into the room. And once the equipment is inside a sterile environment, they're able to unwrap it. That wrap is then placed in the recycle container where previously it would go into the trash. But it's a very desirable plastic. People want it. Unfortunately, it's bulky and it's a little light, so it's not easily diverted into an amount that people are willing to pick up a lot of times, which is where we were able to partner with the Benton County Solid Waste District and bring them in as the people that actually haul the material.
Swearingen says once the hospital fills its bins, the Benton County Solid Waste District will pick up the blue wrap and store the material in one of its facilities. Once there is enough material to create a load, the Waste District will send it out of state to a buyer. Swearingen says this program, which is the first of its kind in Arkansas and one of only a handful in the region, really highlights the Waste District's commitment to forming local partnerships that create a good value for Benton County businesses. He says the program also highlights Mercy's commitment to sustainability. Since opening in 2008, Mercy's Rogers Hospital has received the Energy Star label from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency 5 times. In addition to using less energy, Rick Barclay, Vice President in Administration at Mercy Hospital in Rogers, says he thinks they are doing things that are pretty creative in the healthcare industry.
With lighting, you know, we've gone to a lot of automatic shutoff and light harvesting to where we're blessed with a really bright building with lots of windows, and so we have gained, we feel like we're doing very well in our energy management by seeing the lights that shut off automatically after a certain number of minutes. Motion detectors in certain areas like bathrooms, and we recycle batteries, we recycle cardboard, and then we also really discourage printing. We've moved, you know, to electronic health record. We have where people can access their record online. So we've watched our printing really, really reduce, and we've established a day of the week, which is No Print Thursday, where we ask people, do not print unless you absolutely have to.
Adding the blue wrap recycling program to the hospital's sustainability practices will help Mercy Northwest Arkansas reduce waste and save money. Barclay explains they have to pay a fee each time the trash dumpster is pulled. Originally, the dumpster had to be pulled a couple of times a week, but Barclay says he thinks they can get that down to once a week, which would save them about $250 every week. While cost savings are important to a business, Barclay says doing the right thing is also valuable.
You know, we try to look at the cost side, but we also, as we have a sister of Mercy, Sister Anita DeSalvo, who participates on our green team, she continues talking about us being a good steward of the earth, and it's just the right thing to do, and it fits the Mercy charisms. And so we do look at a return on investment, but we also look at, we try to do things because it's the right thing to do as well.
For more information, you can visit mercy.net/northwestarar, or you can visit p3wc.com.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blues Show, where local and international artists get showcased for over 22 years. You know, anymore, the blues casts a wide net. As new generations emerge, the look and the sound of the blues continues to evolve. Tune in every Friday night at 9 o'clock to see what I've captured next on listener-supported KUAF. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. Earning reports filter in. Who's up? Who's down? Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas has the details.
Home BancShares, parent company of Centennial Bank, reported a record first quarter profit on Thursday. The Conway-based financial institution posted profits of $27 million, up from $17.5 million 1 year ago. Home BancShares acquired Jonesboro-based Liberty Bank shares last year for about $280 million, and late Thursday it said it's buying another Florida bank for around $43 million. Simmons First National had an up-and-down quarter, depending on how you view their latest financial results. The Pine Bluff-based bank posted first-quarter net income of $4.35 million, compared to nearly $6 million 1 year ago. However, after settling one-time charges associated with its acquisition of Little Rock-based Metropolitan National, Simmons First core earnings were almost $7.5 million for the quarter. Bank of the Ozarks reported a 26% increase in its first quarter 2014 net income as the Little Rock-based financial institution saw an unexpected bump in seasonal loan activity. First quarter profits topped $25 million, up from $20 million 1 year ago. J.B. Hunt posted a first quarter net income decline due to service disruptions related to harsh weather earlier this year. J.B. Hunt's profits still topped $68.6 million, but that was down 6.5% from the same period last year. Quarterly revenues climbed higher for J.B. Hunt to $1.4 billion, up from $1.29 billion last year. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon and his wife Shelley are donating $1 million to the University of Arkansas Walton College of Business. The gift will establish the McMillon Family Endowed Excellence Fund, which is expected to serve as the catalyst for a proposed School of Global Retail Operations and Innovation. This week, the Arkansas Highway Commission redesignated I-540 as I-49. Signs will be replaced during the coming month. I-49 is part of a north-south 1,700-mile interstate system that connects New Orleans and Canada. I-49 runs through Arkansas from Texarkana to Fort Smith to Bella Vista. Monroe & Company, which makes shoes at its Hot Springs headquarters and a plant in Clarksville, says it will lay off 56 workers over the course of the next 6 months due to competitive pressure abroad. Monroe & Company is a domestic shoe manufacturer and importer. Its principal brands include women's footwear, which is sold in department stores and specialty boutiques nationwide. The ACLU and the Arkansas Public Law Center filed lawsuits on behalf of four individuals in regard to the state's controversial voter identification law. The law was passed by the Republican-controlled General Assembly in 2013 over a veto by Democratic Governor Mike Beebe. The suit seeks a court injunction that the ACLU hopes to take effect before the primary elections next month. Overall, the ACLU seeks to have the law completely thrown out. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business and Politics update.
Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T. Challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. Girls rock, and I'm not just saying that because I am one. An organization with that name is hosting an event this Thursday evening with the aim of drawing attention to the barriers to education that girls face both locally and around the world. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with the organizers of the event and has this report.
Now in its third year, Girls Rock at Ramey Junior High in Fayetteville is an organization made up of 11 eighth grade girls who have been identified as students with great leadership potential, brought together to try to give them opportunities to develop those skills, to connect them with the community and let them grow and spread their wings so they'll see what an impact they can have. GIRLS stands for Girls in Real Life Situations. Cindy Cottle is the sponsor of the organization and a counselor at Ramey Junior High.
We do make sure that those 11 girls are plugged in to every opportunity that comes through Ramey Junior High School. Many of the things that we do, helping them to network in the community. We have what we call Career Cafe. We bring in representatives from the University of Arkansas. We had Brian Hembry on campus, and Girls Rock girls always get plugged in right away with those things, and we make sure that they have that opportunity.
The group has learned the importance of giving back through an event at Powerhouse Restaurant that raised money for Safety Net, an organization that benefits all kids in Fayetteville Public Schools. The girls have attended yoga class, painting with a twist, a cooking class, had lessons in skincare, and they plan to complete a ropes course together. The group gets to go on a field trip about once a month. The 11 don't try out and don't apply for the group. Miss Caudell and other teachers handpick the girls to be part of the group. Willow Ahrens is 14 years old and remembers when she found out that she had been chosen.
I do. I was very excited because my older sister was in it for ninth grade last year. And she'd always tell me about it, all the opportunities she had, all the field trip things she got to go on. And now that I'm a part of it, I'm really happy.
Janice Givens is library media specialist at Ramey and served as an educational envoy to Ukraine with the United States State Department last year. Through that position, she was connected with the organization behind the film Girl Rising. That's a documentary that draws attention to the need to remove barriers to education for females around the world.
We did a screening of the film, and I was on fire. It's an incredibly moving film, and I immediately thought about our Girls Rock. The previous librarian is actually teaching in the United Arab Emirates now, and before she left, she wrote for a grant to provide us the opportunity to do a library project and tie that in with another student organization. So this was perfect for that. We are pushing a global education reading initiative with this. We've ordered quite a few books and have those now in our library and available, and having discussions among our student classes about those topics.
Givens says this is the perfect connection between Girls Rock and the global initiative, and it will enable the program to make an impact locally. Saying you must start at home to make an impact globally. Givens says that though many may not realize it, girls in the local community also face barriers to education.
Whether it's economic opportunities to go to college, even community college or technical schools, we have students in this area that are facing limitations in that area. And I think sometimes we want to think this is something that happens in Nepal or something that happens in Peru. Those are two of the countries that are focused on in the film. But there are situations here. We have girls here who need encouragement, and they need doors open for them to be able to have those opportunities.
Willow Ahrens has not seen the entire film, but did watch a vignette about a girl named Suma in Nepal.
And it was about how her mother and father sold her into slavery when she turned 10, I think, and how all of her brothers go to school and why she can't go to school. And it kind of scarred me because I knew that I could go to school and I want other girls to have that opportunity.
Studies have shown that educated girls stand up for their rights, marry and have children, later educating their own children and their families. Therefore, communities thrive. The film has spurred an international movement raising awareness and funds to motivate leaders to take action. Helping just one girl can have a huge impact in the local and global community. Here's Janice Givens.
That one girl, when you look at the opportunities that can be provided to her and what the potential for her is, she's going to impact her community in many ways, socially, culturally, but she's also going to impact her community financially, economically, but that spreads to other girls as well. So that impact I don't think can be measured in concrete numbers of the economic, the social, the educational impact of that.
Willow Ahrens does not take her education for granted and recognizes the impact she could have when joined together with girls around the globe.
I know girls are already noticing all the problems around, even around like the world. There was this one girl in Haiti, her name was Wadley, and she noticed that boys were getting more education, and she wanted that education. And I found a quote, says, "Even if you send me away, I will come back every day until I can stay." So I know that she wants the education. I know girls are noticing it all around the world, and the awareness is starting now, and we can only make it bigger.
A screening of the film Girl Rising will be presented Thursday evening at 6:30 in the Fayetteville High School Performing Arts Center. This free event is hosted by Girls Rock. The organization had a hand in the events organization, event planning being yet another skill the group learns.
it made me feel really good about myself because I knew I was helping other girls, and I was handing out invitations. I was telling everybody about it. I was, like, going out of my way to make sure people knew about it, and it was nice.
Other area organizations that aid children and women in the community will be represented in order to draw awareness to the situations locally and the places the community can turn if they need a helping hand. Not only girls and women, but men and boys are also invited to Thursday screening. In many locales, it is the male influence that prevents opportunities for females.
It would just be really nice if everybody, like, figured out that we're all equal and we all need education, not just because you're a girl that you shouldn't have education.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Fleming discovered penicillin, the Curies discovered radium, and Einstein discovered that it was all relative. I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, I'm hoping that you'll discover the latest advances in science and technology when we talk to people who make them and find out what it all means to you. That's on Science Friday from PRI.
Listen Friday from 1 to 3 p.m. to 91.3 FM.
It is Monday, April 21st, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoine Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
It's a themed day.
Excellent.
Musical Monday.
I like it.
That seems so easy. But there's all sorts of things going on. There's a jazz ensemble spring concert at 7:30 today at the Arkansas Union Theater at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite admission price?
Free.
The Latin ensemble performs at 7:30 Wednesday at the Stella Boyle Smith Concert Hall at the UA.
Also
free.
Okay.
The Opera Theater performs at 6:30 Thursday, also at Stella Boyle Smith, also
free.
And Justin Moore is back in town.
Is he?
He is. Arkansas native, he will be back for a show at 7 o'clock Thursday at the Fort Smith Convention Center.
Oh.
Joining Moore for this stop on the tour is Randy Houser. And tickets start at $38.50 at Ticketmaster.com.
Lots of music this week. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkan Songs.
Bye, bye, Jesse. Bye, bye, Jesse. Jesse is gone, gone, gone.
Jesse Belvin was indeed the whole package. A talented, handsome singer, songwriter, and arranger. Some of Belvin's best-known songs include Earth Angel, Dream Girl, Guess Who, and Goodnight, My Love. His most lasting impact as a prolific mastermind behind West Coast doo-wop music may never be fully calculated, as he was careless with credits and publishing rights. Also sketchy are his birth origins, possibly Texarkana in 1933 or San Antonio, Texas in 1932. By the late 1950s, Belvin had signed a solo deal with major label RCA Victor. The company's PR team began a campaign branding Jesse Belvin after his RCA label mate as the Black Elvis. With a major label solo deal and a big tour set for 1960, the new decade must have seemed full of opportunity for Belvin. But it wasn't to be. Belvin died in a fiery crash in Hempstead County the morning following a showcase concert in Little Rock. He'd been en route to another show in Fort Worth, Texas. Although Belvin is only on the cusp of solo fame, his musical contributions, especially in doo-wop, were acknowledged in the tribute song heard here, Goodbye, Jesse Belvin, by the Legends.
What's the matter with you, baby, 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 baby? What's the matter with you, baby, 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 baby? February 5th, 1960, Little Rock Concert was at Robinson Auditorium downtown. It was billed as the first rock and roll show of 1960. Headlining the big cavalcade of entertainment stars was Jackie Wilson. Wilson was the only performer to merit a photograph in the Arkansas Gazette newspaper advertisement. Also appearing were Bobby Freeman, Marv Johnson, and Baby Washington. Arthur Prysock, Nappy Brown, Bobby Lewis, and Willis Jackson rounded out the bill with newly minted major label solo star Jesse Belvin near the bottom. Tickets were $1.75. It's long been whispered that Belvin's car accident happened as a result of his car being tampered with, and that that occurred as a result of tension due to the show being among the first racially integrated at the venue. But the concert was segregated by skin color. In fact, the concert was actually two concerts, a 6:50 p.m. show for whites and an 8 p.m. show and dance for Negroes. The ad in the Gazette didn't bother mentioning the late show.
Good night, my love. Pleasant dreams and sleep tight, my love. May tomorrow be sunny and bright, and bring you closer to me.
Nothing has ever been proven regarding any malfeasance in the Jesse Belvin accident. Belvin and his entourage weren't the only persons of note to perish in the two-car crash either. Max Gene Noel was a deep-sea diver of renown based out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. According to the Arkansas Gazette, he had been recently planning a second try at salvaging a Dutch motor ship in Lake Michigan. The Gazette reported Arkansas State Trooper Dwight Pankey as saying the Cadillac carrying the Belvins was in the wrong lane that morning when it collided with the other vehicle. The Knowles car burst into flames. A passing motorist was able to pull one from the blazing car, but both Mr. and Mrs. Knoll died at the scene. So did Charles Ford, 34, of New York City, who was in the Belvin vehicle, and Belvin himself. Belvin's 25-year-old wife, Joanne, and another entertainer in the Belvin car, Kirk Davis, were taken to Texarkana for treatment, but died of their injuries. Traffic was blocked on U.S. Highway 67 for nearly 2 hours as the Hope Fire Department extinguished the blazing wreckage. The accident occurred 6 miles west of Hope.
Good night, my love. Pleasant dreams.
Decades after his Hempstead County death, just as he was seemingly poised for bigger things, Texarkana's Jesse Belvin is indeed known around the world, albeit mostly by deep fans of American doo-wop. Here in its entirety is Love of My Life, an unissued song demo by alleged Texarkana native Jesse Belvin, who died in Hempstead County in 1960, the morning following a Little Rock concert.
Ernie, I think you like this.
How can you tell, George?
Love of my life, you're the heart and soul of my life. You're the dream I dream each night. My love will never change. Oh, you are the one. Heaven sent you and meant you for me. And I know my love for you will never ever change. I trade the world for you and all its gold. There's nothing I wouldn't do. I'd even go to Mars and bring you back the stars. There's nothing I wouldn't do. Oh, love of my life, you're the heart and soul of my life. You're the dream I dream each night. my love will never change.
Love of My Life, an unissued song demo by Jesse Belvin, who died near Hope in Hempstead County on February 6, 1960, the morning following a Little Rock concert. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information or to subscribe to the podcast, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. John L. Hancox may be the most influential Arkansas musician most people have never heard of, or even heard. He was born in Brinkley in 1904 and was an influential force behind the formation of the Southern Tenants Farm Union. He also, in his 30s, began writing poems and songs to support the labor movement. He left Arkansas in the 1930s and was not heard from for most of the next 50 years. Michael K. Honey, a professor of humanities at the University of Washington in Tacoma, has written a book about the life of John L. Hancox called Sharecropper's Troubadour. Earlier this month, Michael K. Honey visited the University of Arkansas, and during his visit, he told Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums that he wrote the book, in part, to bring the story of John L. Hancox to a wider audience.
He disappeared in 1937-38. A lynch mob ran him out of eastern Arkansas. And the only reason we know about him at all is that after he left Arkansas, he did a series of recordings with Pete Seeger's father, Charles Seeger, at the Library of Congress. And so those are still there, and there's a CD of those songs now from the University of West Virginia Press. But then he left the South altogether and went to San Diego. And Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and other people put together a book. Alan Lomax put together a book of songs called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People about the Great Depression. John's got some great material in there, and they tried to find him in 1967 when that book came out, and they couldn't find any trace of him. They thought he was dead. And in 1985, I was a graduate student, and I was living in Washington, D.C., and we had these things called the Great Labor Arts Exchange, where we'd bring in musicians, and I organized a panel on labor and civil rights and songs of the South, and Pete Seeger was one of the panelists, and just right around that same time, he discovered John Hancox was still alive, and so we brought him to the conference, and he was a tremendous hit.
He would have been early 80s at this point,
he would have
right?
been, I think, about 84 okay. or something like that. And he was very stately and a little bit frail, but still pretty robust. And as soon as he walked in the room and started singing Roll the Union On, everybody burst into song because everybody knew that song. And he became a huge hit on sort of the labor folk scene. And he started traveling with Pete Seeger. He was at the Vancouver Folk Festival, which is a huge event in Canada, and various labor kind of oriented events for the next 7 years, and then he died. So he had like a second life. I call him, his first poems that he wrote were published in the Southern Tenant Farmers Union newspaper, The Sharecropper's Voice, and he used the pen name John Henry because he didn't want the planters to know his real name. John Henry being the famous steel-driving man of the great folk song. So in 1985, I called it the Second Coming of John Henry because he was that same kind of historical,
right.
mythological sort of figure.
Larger than life.
Larger
sort of.
Than life. So he came back, you know, but he could just as easily have languished in total obscurity. And then when I was there at this event, Ralph Rinsler, who ran the Smithsonian Folklife Program, said, well, you can't just bring this person here. Somebody's got to interview him. So he paid me $100, and I went and interviewed him for a couple of days. And that got this project started, but it took me all these years later to come back to it and turn it into a book.
You mentioned that he left eastern Arkansas in 1937.
Mm-hmm.
A lynch mob coming for him because of his activities trying to organize?
Yes. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union was a really incredible occurrence. John grew up in Brinkley, Arkansas in 1904. He was born there, as you mentioned, sort of a contemporary of Rosetta Tharpe and Louis Jordan, and also a guy named Big Bill Brunze. They all came from that area. Well, all of those musicians left except John, and he was really not a musician. He was in a large family, 11 brothers and sisters, working on rented and purchased land, and they were actually in pretty good shape until the 1920s, and then everything went bad in cotton country. The prices of cotton dropped after World War One, and then his father got killed by a team of runaway mules that threw him out of the wagon. He hit his head against a tree and broke his neck, and John sat there and watched him die. And so then John took over the family with these 11 or 10 siblings. And by the 1930s, he had become a sharecropper. They said that, you know, you had an agricultural ladder and each step would take you up, but instead each step took him down. So he went from being sort of self-sufficient to being a sharecropper, which is totally not self-sufficient. And finally, in 1935, a group of people in Tyranza, Arkansas, organized the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, and that's where the story kind of starts. And that union was amazing because the last time anybody tried to organize sharecroppers in Arkansas was 1919 in Lane, Arkansas.
And we know what happened
there.
It
had a huge race riot. Hundreds of people were killed, lynchings and everything else. And, of course, the trick there was they turned the whites against the blacks. And so when they organized in 1934, they had only seven people to start it. They said, well, should we have separate unions because blacks and whites are not supposed to be, you know, together in according to the segregation laws. And they said one of the survivors of the Elaine massacre, African-American, said, no, you know, that's how they killed us last time. We can't do that. So it wasn't, they weren't seeking integration. They didn't talk about it that way. They just talked about it. We're all in this together. And they did some really significant things. They used Mr. and Mrs. titles for everybody. So that meant whites were calling blacks Mr. or Mrs. Instead of auntie and uncle and all the demeaning ways people would talk. That was just a rule. And also they held interracial meetings. And so John's role, eventually, they had a big strike in 1935 during the harvest season that was successful and raised their incomes by 50%. So suddenly they had 30,000 members all over Arkansas, southeast Missouri, parts of Oklahoma. And John wasn't in the union at that point, but he started, he was going door to door selling fish. He quit sharecropping, and he started fishing out of the river and taking the fish in buckets and going door to door. He was pretty entrepreneurial, and he also made pop and moonshine and popcorn, and he sold that from a mule, you know, walking around or going around with a mule. And so while he was going door to door, he started collecting union memberships. And on these plantations, these were like police states where you were totally controlled by the landlord, but he would just come to the door and sell you something. And meanwhile, wouldn't you like to join this union?
I'm curious, do we know, was he writing, and maybe you asked him about this when you interviewed him in the 80s, did he write for himself or did he consciously write songs that he knew would have a good chance of bringing people together, that would rally people together?
He was writing for the union. He wasn't writing for himself. Let me his first poem. Was called The Planter and the Sharecropper, and it was published under the name of John Henry and appeared in the Sharecropper's Voice. And it's a very long poem, and I don't think anybody who had not lived that life would be able to describe things the way he does. I won't play the whole thing because it's too long, but so I put a little tune to it. The planter lives off the sweat of the sharecropper's brow.
how the sharecropper lives, the planter cares not how. The planter has good and wholesome food to eat. Sharecropper gets cornbread and fat bag meat. Sharecropper's wife goes to the kitchen, wash tub and field. Planter's wife enjoys a fancy automobile. Planter's children dresses fine and goes to school. Sharecropper's puts on rags and follows the mule. Oh, when a sharecropper dies, he's buried in a box without any necktie, without any socks. And if anybody doubts this ain't the truth, you can go down south and you can see the proof. Well, planter, what the heaven is the matter with you? What has your labor ever done to you? Upon his back, you just a sit and ride. Don't you think your labor gonna ever get tired?
We mentioned that there were the recordings at the Library of Congress, but he also kind of went out of the public eye. Did he keep writing during that time?
You know, I'm not sure. He you know, to make a living, he became very entrepreneurial once again. He built houses, had people who were migrants from the South rent. So it's just like most immigrants, you know, there'd be 10, 15 people sleeping in a house. And then he raised vegetables and sold them off the back of a truck, went fishing, sold the fish, became a carpenter for a while, but discovered there was a lot of racism in the union. So that was an issue for him, too. So most of the time, he was just trying to make a living and taking care of grandchildren and stuff like that. And he had three marriages, so he was busy that way, too. I think the music sort of came back to him in the 80s. By the time I met him in 85, he had actually started writing again and had gotten some attention in San Diego in the newspapers. And then he really wrote a lot of things from then on in. He wrote a lot of poems about growing old, hospitalization, what that was like, love poems. And then he wrote these political ones. Let me do just one quick thing. This was something he sent me the words to, and then we worked on it together and presented it at the Labor Heritage Foundation. So this is 1986, during the reign of Ronald Reagan. Jobless, jobless in the USA. People are looking for work every day. Someone has taken their jobs away. Jobless in the USA. Hunger, hunger in the USA. People are going into garbage cans. Someone's taking their jobs away. Hunger in the USA. Homeless, homeless in the USA. People are living in cars every day. People without a place to stay. The banks have taken their homes away. Homeless in the USA. Working, working in the USA. Working for a better day. Working till we have some say. We're gonna make some changes in the USA. We gotta make some changes in the USA. So he was still thinking very politically, and in my interviews with him, he talked a lot about his fear that mechanization was throwing all these people out of work. It happened where he was originally with cotton production, mm-hmm. but it was happening with everything else. And he told me, he said, a lot of times I wake up at night sort of sweating and thinking, what's going to happen to all these people when they don't have jobs anymore?
Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask if you got a sense, here he was in his 80s, everything he had been through, had seen. Did you get a sense whether he had any optimism for the future? Did you talk to him about
that? He was very optimistic. That was an interesting thing about him. Someone growing up in his circumstances, this surprised me actually when I put the book together. The book was a lot of research on my part because I had the interviews with him, but I didn't have the context. And he told me his personal story, but I needed to understand what was going on around that story. So it took me a long time, actually, to piece it all together. And under the circumstances, I was really surprised at how optimistic he was. So his ninth grade, what he called his graduation speech, he talked about scaling the heights of glory, and the principal asked him what did he want to be when he grew up, and he said, I want to be like George Washington. He said, oh, you mean George Washington Carver. He said, no, I mean, I want to be the president. And that never left him, you know, despite all the things that happened to him, you know, the privations and the almost starvation and the lynch mob. And he always was can do. And I think it came out of his family being a little bit better off in the sense that they owned some land at the beginning and that they had their own chickens and cows and were self-sufficient and didn't go into debt until the 20s. And so he always knew that it was possible to live a decent life. And he just kept fighting for that. And he said at the end, I'm going to live till I die anyway, so I'm going to make the best out of whatever I have. And he just was like that. He was an inspiring character.
Michael K. Henney is a professor of humanities at the University of Washington and the author of the book Sharecropper's Troubadour about Arkansas-born John L. Hancock's. You can learn more about the author, the book, and the subject at michaelhenney.com. He was on the University of Arkansas campus earlier this month, and during his visit, he talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums. KUAF is supported by Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. These daily newspapers offer local, state, national, and international news, plus business and Razorback news. NWAOnline.com for more information. KUAF is supported by the fully remodeled and expanded Walmart Museum, a family-friendly experience featuring interactive displays on the history of Walmart, Walton's Five and Dime, and the Spark Cafe Soda Fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m., including Sundays. 277-8493 or facebook.com/Walmart Museum for more information. KUAF Night with the Naturals will be April 24th, that's this Thursday, at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. KUAF ticket holders will be seated together as the Naturals host the Springfield Cardinals at 7.05 p.m. KUAF tickets are only available at 927-4063, or you can click the banner at KUAF.com to email an order. A portion of ticket sales will benefit your public radio station, KUAF 91.3 FM. And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Wheeler. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.